Where have I got to in the story? Oh, yes. 3 weeks of preparation give way to a 40-day season, which then, of course, becomes about more than just preparing for baptism, particularly where baptisms are no longer happening on January the 6th in many places. And so it begins to adopt many of the features of Lent. And so it begins to look more like a second Lent, and that's dominated through history. One of the major understandings of the period before Christmas, that it's the equivalence of Lent. And so it takes on the penitential aspects of Lent. It eventually takes on the purple vestments of Lent, the not singing of the Gloria in Excelsis in Lent. All those Lenten things gradually become part of this evolving Advent. We have another tradition coming into it, and that's the Roman tradition, which never had baptismal preparation for Christmas. Well, of course, it never had baptismal preparation for January the 6th either, because it didn't practice January the 6th to begin with. But when December the 25th was set up, it had no baptismal connotations. But there was the notion of a penitential preparation for the great festival. Most festivals have some sort of penitential preparation to balance, you know, fast and feast and so on. But the length at Rome varied, and 6 weeks seems to have been the earliest tradition of the length of Advent at Rome, and only eventually shortened down to 4 weeks, and adopts those penitential elements that I was just talking about, including the purple vestments, Gloria in Excelsis, but not the same fasting rules. It doesn't quite replicate Lent, but it does go some way towards it. So in that way, the fasting element is not as strong, but the other liturgical customs are. While we're on Rome and the 4 weeks, which it eventually becomes, I should mention Rose Sunday. I can never remember. Do we have rose vestments here? I don't think we do we?
No.
Thank God. Exactly. Well, I completely agree with you. You're all right. Yes. But we need to talk about things we don't like as well as things we do like. Again, it's a custom that developed from Lent in Rome, that it was meant to be a sort of mid-Lent Sunday. Well, you can't put exactly Lent in half because it doesn't work that way. You'd end up, the middle of Lent would be in the middle of the week. So the nearest Sunday became a Sunday for rose-coloured vestments in Lent, and naturally enough, it gets copied for the 4 weeks of Advent. Meanings are found for this when it was really just a pause originally in the rigors of real Lent. As I say, traditions became attached to it, and eventually the rose-coloured vestments that everybody thinks look pink, which I do too, but they call them rose, but it really... There we are. Enough said about that, I think. Naturally enough, regardless of Advent as such, people wanted to have some sort of lectionary preparation for Christmas Day. You just don't, you know, come up to Christmas and there it is. So there was a natural tendency to place commemorating the Annunciation two Sundays before Christmas and the ministry of John the Baptist, so as to provide the pre-evangelical sequence. Even though March the 25th was being observed as the Annunciation, 9 months from Christmas, and indeed may have been the cause of Christmas, as we saw last week. So Annunciation, in a sense, gets covered twice in the year. But that didn't seem to bother people. It was already established in March, but they needed, if not a festival called that, at least to reuse the readings in Advent, and the same with John the Baptist, who has his own day, but to reuse the readings as preparation for Christmas. So what you get really is a mixture between, oh, it's a second Lent, and we need to do most of the rigors of Lent, and, oh, it's preparation for Christmas, so we need to have readings that are appropriate to that. And so you see what I say, it doesn't have a single theme, just two themes mingling together. And they are really two ways of looking at time, because some of the church's festivals are predicated on a truly chronological sequence, as March 25th to December the 25th. You have the exact 9 months. But from a symbolic point of view, that's not very convenient, because March 25th tends to end up falling in Lent then, or even Easter week, or whatever. It sort of overlaps another part of the cycle, whereas other festivals are in a theological relationship, or if not festivals, at least readings are in a theological relationship. You know, you put it the week before to prepare people for what's going to be commemorated next week, even if, you know, John the Baptist wasn't around at Christmas, you know. It's still part of the preparation for the gospel. So that's why the liturgical year is a bit of a mess, and why the revisions made in the middle of the 20th century were designed to clean that up to some extent. But of course, some traditions are so deeply rooted on certain days that they didn't move away. But at least it tried to have a sequence through the year that followed the order of events. A final strand, gosh, we're getting through this stuff really fast today. That's when you have notes, it helps. a final strand was the sense that the Sundays before Christmas formed the end of the year. In effect, they formed the end of the civil year in many places before you get to the winter solstice. And so readings that were appropriate to the end of the year, or rather to the end of time, tend to be assigned to the Sundays in November, December. And so again, surprisingly, in the ancient tradition, one of those was reading the entry into Jerusalem, Palm Sunday, in effect, on the first Sunday of Advent. And the old lectionaries have the entry into Jerusalem because it's seen as symbolic of the Lord coming to take possession of what is truly his. And so readings that are refer to the end of time, or that symbolically are understood to be about that, and that was one, are clustered around what was the end of the year. So Advent, although we talk about Advent Sunday as the beginning of a new year, historically it's a mixture. It's the end of the year, and so the tendency of the first, well, now we've only got four Sundays, but when there were more, a tendency of the first few Sundays to focus on the end of time and the coming of Christ in glory, with preparing for Christmas, which looks forward. And so you rapidly move from death and judgment through to the prospect of the birth of the Saviour. And they sort of mingle together. Well, even though the entry to Jerusalem has disappeared in modern revisions, that doesn't mean that the whole theme of that has disappeared. And indeed, it came to dominate so much in the course of history that there came to be a tradition of preaching on the Sundays of Advent with regard to the end of time. And so they became the four last things: heaven and hell, death and judgment. Not a very cheery preparation for Christmas, but well established. So,
well, it must be there because there are four Sundays.
Yeah. Well, no, if there'd been five, they'd have come up with another one, you know. Yeah. Christ the King or something. Yeah. It's a joke because that's a modern invention. The generosity of the rector was such that 2 years ago, was it? He invited me to preach on the occasion of Christ the King. And I don't really believe in that festival because the festival of Christ the King is Ascension, you know? And then I realized why he'd chosen that. It wasn't out of spite for me. That year, it was the Sunday after Thanksgiving. And so this lot all wanted a week off. But I did my best to preach on Christ the King, in spite of not believing in it. To return to Advent proper, Christ the King was something that the Catholic Church decided to put in its 20th century visions at the end of the year, with Advent following at the beginning of the new year, to sort of stop it fraying at the edges, as it were, to end with a triumphal note rather than just next Sunday. So Advent came in one sense to be dominated by the sort of penitential Lent thing, which led to preaching on death, judgment, heaven, hell, and the baptismal associations were long forgotten, and some sort of preparation for Christmas crept in. But as we know, times have changed, and I don't hear people preaching on the four last things, thank goodness. Now we haven't been doing it, we haven't noticed it. That element has sort of drifted away and is just barely visible in some of the lectionary choices on the early Sundays. Although the theme of Christ coming in glory, the two comings, has remained, but without as much of the fearful note. You know, Christ coming at the first time in his birth at Bethlehem, and Christ coming again at the end time in glory to inaugurate the age to come. That sort of theme has remained, even if the secular world has gone entirely for the baby Jesus being born at Christmas and preparing for that, or anticipating it weeks beforehand. I can remember as a child and a young person, the strictness of you weren't allowed to put the Christmas tree up and you weren't allowed to put the crib in church and so on. And you generally weren't allowed to have weddings in Advent, though I was married in Advent just as a rebel. There are a few more things that I can think of, and you may think of others, but in a way, not some very modern, others less so. There's a tradition of what are called the O antiphons being sung from at the daily office, not at the Eucharist, but at the daily office, from December the 17th to the 23rd. So these wouldn't be known to ordinary congregations, but in musical settings, there were always antiphons before and after the canticles. And these, all of which begin with O, mention in effect some of the titles of Jesus: O Wisdom from on High, O Key of David, and so on. If you think about O Come Emmanuel, that's a hymn that was composed out of these antiphons. And if you look through the words, there are all the titles which begin each verse. That's, again, a further adaptation of this great ode, as they're called, in that period. More modern arrivals on the scene.
Uh,
Sorry, couldn't resist it. rarely can I resist anything. Have been the Advent wreath, which, as far as Anglo-Saxon Christianity, is a very modern appearance, though it stems from Germany and Scandinavia particularly, has become adopted in modern times, like the Jesse tree and things like that. If you know about Santa Lucia, with the candles on the head, there's a link there to the candles of the Advent wreath and the countdown to Christmas in that. And inevitably among those who believe in Rose Sunday, a rose-coloured candle as one of the four. So that, and of course, like many things, even if it doesn't have a deep history, because it speaks to people, it becomes widespread, even where more ancient traditions fall away because they no longer represent the piety of the people of the time. And that also brings me, finally, to blue vestments. A modern development trying to distinguish Advent from Lent and saying it's not just another Lent with the same coloured vestments. Now, some churches have sackcloth in Lent to mark it out, which I think works better than purple. See Westminster Abbey, who have sackcloth throughout the season. But many churches have the purple as the marker of Lent, and so there were people who wanted to try and mark out Advent as something other than just a second Lent, a second period of being deprived of stuff and so on. And so the tradition of blue vestments began to emerge. Like all things, they try and find a historical reason why it's all right. It's absolutely true of the development of Christian liturgy and kinds. Is that the thing comes along, and then you find a historical reason about why it should be so. The introduction of what in England is called the parish communion, that is, a communion mid-morning on a Sunday, after the quiet 8 o'clock, where earliness is next to godliness, and at the main morning service, which in those days would have been sung morning prayer, the development of this, and 9 o'clock became the sort of standard time for this. And I think it was Bishop Wordsworth who looked back in history and discovered that that's the time that the Eucharist had been celebrated way back in some places. And so it's the canonical hour. So there was a bit of... It wasn't just so that Mum could get home and cook the Sunday dinner and people were... could have a bit of a lie-in before instead of going to 8 o'clock. But it was the canonical hour that determined why it should be then. Well, the same with blue vestments. People dug back into the variegated colours of the Middle Ages because the standard sequence of vestments that we're used to with green and red and so on is only, a relatively modern thing. Certainly before the Reformation, there were all sorts of traditions at work, particularly in medieval England. And so the sarum use, as it's called, because it was derived from Salisbury, which became the sort of major leader in liturgy in England. Most places followed the sarum use or some variant of it, had a wide range of colours, completely different from the ones we have. So they were able to dig up the fact that blue had been used and justify it. But I personally like blue vestments. I think it's a good thing to try and distinguish Advent from Lent, because it isn't just another period of giving up before we can gorge ourselves at Christmas. It has, if I say a different character, it has a number of different characters. It is and that human beings don't always handle multiplicity of themes. We like, a single meaning. Each item has a single meaning. Eastern Christians do much better at this, juggling two or three biblical themes on a single occasion. But I think it's the analytical mind of the West that wants one thing to correspond with another thing, and that thing only. You know. And so I think we cope less well with Advent, precisely because, to some extent, it is concerned with the end of time, and obviously is concerned with the coming of the Saviour at Bethlehem. Of course, nowadays, because it's already Christmas, everybody puts their trees up earlier, and the stores are full of Christmas stuff as soon as Thanksgiving's over, sometimes before, that by the time you get to Christmas Day, it's over. And so the notion of 12 days of Christmas and going on with it doesn't sit well with modern thinking. And to some extent, the same is true about Easter. We tend, as modern people, to celebrate before the event rather than after the event. And it's a struggle, I think, and a dilemma for the Christian church about how far it moves in that direction and how far it tries to stand firm to some sense of the day is not yet come. The biggest compromise which strikes clergy at this is often the request by various organisations to have a carol service and stretching back through December. And it's difficult to say, we don't do that till after Christmas. Even own churches have their own Christmas carol service a couple of weeks, not an Advent carol service, but a Christmas carol service a couple of weeks before, who've obviously decided to go with the flow and adapt to that. So I think Advent is a misunderstood season. I think it's a worthwhile season, but it is countercultural. There I'll stop and see if you have any comments or questions. Questions I can't answer, probably, yes.
When did fasting and Advent become sort of a popular sort of thing?
If fasting is ever popular.
You can't have your mince pies.
Yeah.
Advent.
Yeah. I think that is, I mean, that in one sense is related to the appropriation of Lenten things, but it never became a whole. And, you know, the tradition of, according to the old prayer book, of the last Sunday before Advent has as its collect, "Stir up, O Lord, we beseech you." And it became known as Stir Up Sunday in England, when you stirred up your mixture for Christmas pudding or Christmas cake and so on. Yeah. As I said, there were those sort of restrictions about not anticipating. But, you know, people always ignore it. I mean, like, you weren't supposed to have sexual intercourse till you were married, but people anticipated it. There was a medieval German tradition that moved the nuptial blessing away from the actual marriage service because they didn't like the thought of the holiness of the nuptial blessing falling on people who were already cohabiting. So, yeah, it's always been a struggle for the church. Does that answer as much as I can?
My mother-in-law, she was... You did your mince pies on
Stir Up
Sunday.
Yeah, yeah.
You didn't touch
them. No,
quite.
Yeah.
Paul?
Yes?
There's a movement among some in the Episcopal Church who are quite certain that this is the authentic way to do it, as we liturgists do, of a seven-week Lent, that was it always was until we messed it up. What do you think?
Well,
seven-week Lent or Advent?
Advent.
I mean Advent,
yeah. I think that stems from the six Sundays of the Roman tradition before it was reduced to four. And it's played well with those who want to do more about the end time, so that the English church, in its modern revisions, had a kingdom season, which covered not Advent, but enabled you to use the weeks, in effect another season was the link, the hinge between preparing for Christmas and Advent and the time before they could create this kingdom season of and so spread that out, because they, you know, it gets lost. People aren't that keen on thinking about the second coming in this time of year. And so it tends to get squeezed out. Well,
I have a question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Can you talk more about why you don't prefer the Rose Sunday?
Oh, yeah. It's partly an instinctive thing about the colour, I have to admit. You know, all these, we can come up with nice official explanations, but the real reason often is I don't like the colour. But because, in a sense, in Lent, the tradition of a mid-Lent Sunday is much older than the practice of wearing rose vestments, and that's a, in the great scheme of things, that's a relatively modern outcome of a trend that already existed in Lent to have some middle. The reading on that Sunday was the feeding of the 5,000, and so it often got called Refreshment Sunday. And in the English tradition, that is Mothering Sunday.
Somebody said the word donuts.
Well, in a sense, you know, it was meant as it was meant as a little break in Lent to keep you going for another in your fasting and so on.
I rebuke them in the name of Jesus. Yeah.
And Mothering Sunday is another one of those festivals where you takes your choice about where its real origin is. The popular folk tale is that was the Sunday on which servants were allowed to go home to visit their mothers, and they took food with them and so on. Whereas another theory is that the epistle reading, the New Testament reading on that Sunday, not the Gospel, was Jerusalem being the mother of us all. I'm trying to remember which book it comes out of, so I don't look. No, I don't think it's Romans. None of us know, because we're clergy. We don't know these things. It must be either Hebrews or... You think it's Hebrews? Yeah, anyway. But you see, the notion that Jerusalem that is above is the mother of us all. So the notion that it was Mothering Sunday was talking about Mother Church and going to the cathedral and so on. But these are folk tales through history. Nobody knows when it started, but it has become very firmly established in England. And of course, now it's always called Mother's Day in England, because the rival institution in May in this country, naturally, we've not changed the date. We won't go that far in England, but we will. The secular world calls it Mother's Day, and it's very hard to find a card that says Mothering Sunday on it. but then, because it was there in Lent, you needed to have something similar in Advent, no matter how short it was. And so, once you got the rose-coloured vestments in Lent, you had to find a place to put them in Advent. So I think it's where it's even less appropriate. Yeah.
So is the idea of an Advent calendar, like it all from Christendom,
as far as I know, it's modern, in my lifetime, you know. I don't know how long before that it began, but I think it is. It's part of the countdown principle to Advent, that one strand of it is preparing and waiting and so on. And so it, I think, works well in relation to that, though it doesn't work so well in relation to abstaining from pleasures, because it's all about pleasures. Yeah, the whiskies of Advent is all right. Yeah. Yes.
Well, since you did start talking this morning about December 26th.
Yeah. Yes.
Is that, does Boxing Day, the traditions in England, have any kind of religious background, or is it more just an English?
No. It, the Christmas feast included 2 days, just as Easter Monday is a public holiday in England as well. It's sort of one after the feast, and is therefore a bank holiday and so on. So you had another day when people went at work, and so all sorts of traditions grew around it, with all sorts of theories about why it's called Boxing Day. You know, is that the day you give out your Christmas box to, you know, the charitable gift to your tenants, if you're a lord of the manor, you know, to your servants, and so on. So the actual word Boxing Day is said to relate to that, but again, with so many...
It's because you boxed up all the Christmas decorations and put them away.
No, you don't. You don't do that till the 12th night. but it also, there was an occasion when people used to do things, still do stupid things like having a dip in the sea, or a game of soccer on the sands between the fire department and the police or whatever, you know, those sorts of things as the public manifestations of it. But as it does arise, I think, not because St. Stephen was so particularly valued, but that Christmas got an extended day which happened to be St. Stephen's Day. Sorry.
One of the quarter days of the year, I don't know if they're celebrated now, but they were in the 19th century, where the rents were due, is Christmas Day.
Yeah.
And in the 19th century, people fled from their tenancies on that day. So that's another complication.
Yeah, and also Christmas was a popular day for weddings among working people, because it was one of the few days they got off in the year, so that your employer did not give you time to get off to get married. So Christmas Day was often used for that. And the quarter days continued until, well, continuing once and still continue, but not only rent was due then, but utility bills were quarterly when I was a younger person. You paid your utility bills on the quarter days. It's only relatively recently that more shorter periods of charging took over, you know, monthly or whatever. When I was growing up, that was still a standard thing, was the four quarter days for, in some cases, rent and certainly utilities. And it seemed very odd to me when I came here paying more regularly. It makes much more sense to pay regularly. And the other thing is it's related to the... I know we've got a long way from Advent, but it's related to the tax year in the UK ending on April the 5th, rather than the end of the calendar year as here. I mean, I know you have to pay your taxes by the 15th, but the tax year is counted from April the 6th to April the 5th every year. That's because it's lovely to know facts that people that generally don't know and are completely inconsequential. But that's what I do my job for. That's because when the calendars changed and were moved by 12 days, they had to shift from the quarter day to April, because otherwise people would have had less than the last quarter would have been less than a quarter, or more than a quarter. Yeah, it moved from March 25th through to April the 5th. And nobody ever, you know, wonders. It's a weird date. It's not the end of a month or anything. Well, have we exhausted the topic? I hope you found it valuable. It isn't just an excursion into archaeology that has no relevance, though it can seem like that. And in a sense, you know, the reason I chose that as my specialty is because I am always interested in where things came from and how did we get here. And that's still my primary interest. But because I think it enriches one's understanding of the season. Most of all, in terms of the point I was making at length last week, in terms of the celebration of the incarnation of the Son of God, you know, a deeply profound theological occasion, rather than the more shallow birthday of the baby Jesus view, which, you know, is fine for children and so on, and the crib and the bambino and all that. But I think we missed the real point, just as we missed the real point about the coming of the kingdom and being ready for that, and the belief in, you know, this is all going somewhere, not just round in circles, and so on. Those things can easily get lost, and feasts come to feature in people's minds for different reasons. And I think it's valuable to know about that, to be reminded of it, and to meditate on these more significant factors.
I have a question, because I know after this service, we introduced the saying of the Angelus on Fourth Advent a couple of years ago, a custom in monastic communities on a regular basis. I wonder, you know, a very Catholic practice, uncommon in Anglican history, but if you have anything to offer to those who will participate in the saying of the Angelus here at the end of this next service.
Well, I mean, I think it's an interesting idea to do it on that occasion, and one can see the appropriateness of it, but its history is really as prayer for laity. The practice in monastic communities was to pray, well, again, there's a whole history of this, so short version, seven times a day or more, and to encourage people to join in. But of course, people couldn't read, so reciting psalms and so on was going to be problematic. The idea was, if people just had a Bible verse or a couple of Bible verses or a particular prayer that they could learn by heart, then that enabled them to pray at regular intervals during the day. And so the Angelus was born out of that, the desire by monasteries to provide something manageable by people. And so was the Catholic Rosary. It's the same principle of you repeat the same things over and over again, because that you can learn by heart, whereas to say, go and recite Psalm, whatever it is, not really possible. And its focus on the incarnation was obviously particularly appropriate. So it was one of a number of things that were tried, but it tended to dominate because of its link with the incarnation. It was more centrally anchored rather than some popular devotion that really didn't get at the heart of the faith. So that's why it triumphed in the long run.
Dr. Bradshaw, thank you. Thank you.